exchange and be shown around generally. I went through it in a daze, Lilienthal told me. Until then, I'd never been inside any stock exchange in my life. It was all mysterious and fascinating. No zoo could have seemed more strange to me. How the stock exchange felt at this stage about having the former wearer of horns on its floor is not recorded. In telling me about his experience with the company, Lilienthal had spoken with zest and had made the whole thing sound mysterious and fascinating. I asked him what, apart from the obvious financial inducement, had led him to devote himself to the affairs of a small firm, and how it had felt for the former boss of TVA and AEC to be, in effect, peddling Adipulgite, kaolin, limestone, and speedy dry. Lilienthal leaned back in his chair and stared at the ceiling. "I wanted an entrepreneurial experience," he said. "I found a great appeal in the idea of taking a small and quite crippled company and trying to make something of it. Building. That kind of building, I thought, is the central thing in American free enterprise, and something I'd missed in all my government work. I wanted to try my hand at it. Now, about how it felt. Well, it felt plenty exciting. It was full of intellectual stimulation, and a lot of my old ideas changed. I conceived a great new respect for financiers, men like André Meyer. There's a correctness about them, a certain high sense of honor that I'd never had any conception of. I found that business life is full of creative, original minds, along with the usual number of second-guessers, of course. Furthermore, I found it seductive. In fact, I was in danger of becoming a slave. Business has its man-eating side, and part of the man-eating side is that it's so absorbing. I found that the things you read, for instance, that acquiring money for its own sake can become an addiction if you're not careful, are literally true. Certain good friends helped keep me on the track. Men like Ferdinand Eberstadt, who became my fellow director after the Adipulgus merger, and Nathan Green, special counsel to Lazard Frere, who was on the board for a while. Green was a kind of business father confessor to me. I remember his saying, "You think you'll make your pile and then be independent. My friend, in Wall Street, you don't just win your independence at one stroke. To paraphrase Thomas Jefferson, you have to win your independence over again every day." I found that he was right about that. Oh, I had my problems. I questioned myself at every step. It was exhausting. You see, for so long, I'd been associated with two pretty far-reaching things, institutions. I had a feeling of identity with them. In that kind of work, you are able to lose your sense of self. Now, with myself to worry about, my personal standards as well as my financial future, I found myself wondering all the time whether I was making the right move. But that part's all in my journal, and you can read it there if you like. This part of Lilienthal's journal was eventually published in 1966. I said I certainly would like to read it, and Lilienthal led me to his study in the basement. It proved to be a good-sized room, whose windows opened on window wells into which strands of ivy were trailing. Light came in from outside, and even a little slanting sunshine, but the tops of the window wells were too high to permit a view of the garden or the neighborhood. Lilienthal remarked, "My neighbor, Robert Oppenheimer, complained about the enclosed feeling when he first saw this room. I told him that was just the feeling I wanted." Then he showed me a filing cabinet, standing in a corner. It contained a journal and rows of loose-leaf notebooks, the earliest of them dating back to its author's high school days. Having invited me to make myself at home, Lilienthal left me alone in his study and went back upstairs. Taking him at his word, I went for a turn or two around the room, looking at the pictures on the walls and finding about what might have been expected. Inscribed photographs from Franklin D. Roosevelt, Harry S. Truman, Senator George Norris, Louis Brandeis, pictures of Lilienthal with Roosevelt, with Wilkie, with Fiorello LaGuardia, with Nelson Rockefeller, with Nehru in India. A night view of the Fontana Dam in the Tennessee Valley, being built under a blaze of electricity supplied by TVA power plants. A man's study reflects himself as he wishes to be seen publicly, but his journal, if he is honest, reflects something else. I had not browsed long in Lilienthal's journal before I realized that it was an extraordinary document, not merely a historical source of unusual interest, but a searching record of a public man's thoughts and emotions. I leafed through the years of his association with minerals and chemicals, and, scattered amid much about family, democratic politics, friends, trips abroad, reflections on national policies, and hopes and fears for the Republic, I came upon the following entries, having to do with business and life in New York. May 24, 1951. Looks as if I am in the minerals business. In a small way, that could become a big way. He goes on to explain that he has just had his first interview with Dr. Gregory and is apparently acceptable to the old man as the new president of the company. May 31, 1951. Starting in business is like learning to walk after a long illness. At first, you have to think. Move the right foot, move the left foot, etc. Then you are walking without thinking. And then walking is something one does with unconsciousness and utter confidence. This latter state, as to business, has yet to come, but I had the first touch of it today. July 22, 1951. I recall Wendell Willkie saying to me years ago, "Living in New York is a great experience. I wouldn't live anywhere else. It is the most exciting, stimulating, satisfying spot in the world," etc. I think this was apropos of some remark I had made on a business visit to New York, that I was certainly glad I didn't have to live in that madhouse of noise and dirt. Last Thursday was a day in which I shared some of Wilkie's feeling. There was a grandeur about the place, an adventure, a sense of being in the center of a great achievement. New York City in the 50s. October 28, 1951. What I'm reaching for, perhaps, is to have my cake and eat it too. But in a way, this is not wholly senseless nor futile. That is, I can have enough actual contact with the affairs of business to keep a sense of reality or develop one. How otherwise can I explain the pleasure I get in visiting a copper mine, or talking to operators of an electric furnace, or coal research project, or watching how Andre Meyer works? But along with that, I want to be free enough to think about what these things mean, free enough to read outside the immediate field of interest. This requires keeping out of status, the absence of which I know makes me vaguely unhappy. December 8, 1952. What is it that investment bankers do for their money? Well, I've certainly had my eyes opened as to the amount of toil, sweat, frustrations, problems, yes, and tears, that has to be gone through. If everyone who has something to sell in the market had to be as meticulous and detailed in his statements about what he is selling as those who offer stock in the market are now, under the truth in securities law, darn little would be sold, in time to be useful at least. December 20th, 1952. My purpose in this Adipulgus venture is to make a good deal of money in a short time, in a way, i.e. old man capital gains, that enables me to keep 3/4 of it, instead of paying 80% or more in income taxes. But there is another purpose, to have had the experience of business. The real reason, or the chief reason, is a feeling that my life wouldn't be complete, living in a business period, that is, a time dominated by the business of business, unless I had been active in that area. What I wanted was to be an observer of this fascinating activity that so colors and affects the world's life, not an observer from without, as a writer, teacher, but from the arena itself. I still have this feeling, and when I get low and glad to chuck the whole thing, as I have from time to time, the sustaining part is that even the bumps and sore spots are experiences, actual experiences within the business world. Then, too, I wanted to be able to make a comparison of the managers of business, the spirit, the tensions, the motivations, etc., with those of government, something I keep doing anyway, and that needs doing to understand either government or business. This requires actual, valid experience in the business world, somewhat comparable to my long hiring out in government matters. I don't kid myself that I will ever be accepted as a businessman, not after those long years when I wore horns, for all of them outside the Tennessee Valley at least, and I feel less defensive, usually shown by belligerence, on this score than I did when I rarely saw a tycoon or a Wall Streeter, whereas now I live with them. January 18, 1953. I am now definitely committed to minerals and chemicals for not less than 3 more years, and morally committed to see the thing through. While I can't conceive that this business will ever seem enough, in end of itself, to make up a satisfactory life, yet the busyness, the activity, the crises, the gambles, the management problems I must face, the judgment about people, all combine to make something far from dull. Add to this the good chance of making a good deal of money. My decision to try business that seemed to so many people a bit of romantic moonshine makes more sense today than it did a year ago. But there is something missing. December 2nd, 1953. Crawford Greenwalt, president of DuPont, introduced me in a speech in Philadelphia. He noted that I had entered the chemical business, bearing in mind that I had previously headed the biggest things in America. Bigger than any private corporations, he was naturally a little nervous about seeing me become a potential competitor. It was kidding, but it was good kidding, and it certainly gave little old Adipolgus quite a notice. June 30, 1954. I have found a new kind of satisfaction, and in a sense fulfillment, in a business career. I really never felt that the consultant thing was being a businessman, or engaging in the realities of a life of business. Too remote from the actual thinking process, the exercise of judgment and decision. In this company, as we are evolving it, there are so many of the elements of fun. The starting with almost nothing, the company depending on patents alone, acquisition, mergers, stock issues, proxy statements, the methods of financing internally and by bank loans. Also, the way stock prices are made, the silly and almost childlike basis upon which grown men decide that a stock should be bought, and at what price. The merger with Edgar, the great subsequent rise in the price of their stock. The review of the price structure, the beginning of better costs. The catalyst idea, the drive and energy and imagination. The nights and days in the lab until 2 a.m. night after night, and finally, the beginning of a new business. It is quite a story.
Later, I got a rather different perspective on Lilienthal's reactions to the transition from government to business by talking to the man he had described as his business father confessor, Nathan Green. What happens to a man who leaves top-level government work and comes to Wall Street as a consultant? Green asked me rhetorically. Well, usually it's a big letdown. In the government, Dave was used to a sense of great authority and power, tremendous national and international responsibility. People wanted to be seen with him. Foreign dignitaries sought him out. He had all sorts of facilities, rows of buttons on his desk. He pushed them, and lawyers, technicians, accountants appeared to do his bidding. All right. Now he comes to Wall Street. There's a big welcoming reception. He meets all the partners of his new firm and their wives. He's given a nice office with a carpet. But there's nothing on his desk. Only one button, and all it summons is a secretary. He doesn't have perquisites like limousines. Furthermore, he really has no responsibility. He says to himself, I'm an idea man. I've got to have some ideas. He has some. But they're not given much attention by the partners. So the outward form of his new work is a letdown. The same with its content. In Washington, it had been development of natural resources, atomic energy or the like, world-shaking things. Now it turns out to be some little business to make money. It all seems a bit petty. Then there's the matter of the money itself. In the government, our hypothetical man didn't need it so badly. He had all these services and the basic comforts supplied to him at no personal cost. And besides, he had a great sense of moral superiority. He was able to sneer at people who are out making money. He could think of somebody in his law school class who was making a pile in the street and say, "He's sold out." Then our man leaves government and goes to the Wall Street fleshpots himself, and he says, "Boy, am I gonna make these guys pay for my services." They do pay, too. He gets big fees for consulting. Then he finds out about big income taxes, how he has to pay most of his income to the government now instead of getting his livelihood from it. The shoe is on the other foot. He may, sometimes he does, begin to scream, "Confiscation!" just like any old Wall Streeter. How did Dave handle these problems? Well, he had his troubles, after all. He was starting a second sort of life. But he handled them just about as well as they can be handled. He was never bored, and he never screamed, "Confiscation!" He has a great capacity for sinking himself in something. The subject matter isn't so important to him. It's almost as if he were able to think that what he's doing is important whether it is or not, simply because he's doing it. His ability was invaluable to Minerals and Chemicals, and not just as an administrator. Dave is a lawyer, after all. He knows more about corporate finances than he likes to admit. He enjoys playing the barefoot boy, but he's hardly that. Dave is an almost perfect example of somebody who kept his independence while getting rich on Wall Street. One way and another, then, reading through these ambivalent protestations in the journal, and later hearing Green, I seemed to detect under the exuberance and the absorption a nagging sense of dissatisfaction, almost of compromise. For Lilienthal, the obviously genuine thrill of having a new kind of experience, and an almost unimaginably profitable one, had been, I sensed, a rose with a worm in it. I went back up to the living room. There I found Lilienthal flat on his back on a Shah's rug, underneath a pile of preschool-age children. At least, it looked at first glance like a pile. On closer inspection, I found that it consisted of just two boys. Mrs. Lilienthal, who had returned from the garden, introduced them as Alan and Daniel Bromberger, sons of the Lilienthal's daughter Nancy and Sylvan Bromberger, adding that the Brombergers were living nearby, since Sylvan was teaching philosophy at the university. A few weeks later, Bromberger moved on to the University of Chicago. The Lilienthal's only other offspring, David Jr., lived in Edgartown, Massachusetts, where he had settled down to become a writer, as he subsequently did. In response to the urging of the senior Lilienthal's, the grandchildren climbed off their grandfather and disappeared from the room. When things were normal again, I told Lilienthal my reaction to the entries I had read in the journal, and he hesitated for a while before speaking. "Yes," he said finally. "Well, one thing, it wasn't making all that money that worried me. That didn't make me feel either good or bad by itself. In the government years, we'd always paid our bills, and by scrimping, we'd been able to save enough to send the kids to college. We'd never thought much about money. And then, making a lot of it, making a million, I was surprised, of course. I'd never especially aimed at that or thought it might happen to me. It's like when you're a boy and you try to jump 6 feet. Then you find you can jump 6 feet and you say, well, so what? It's sort of irrelevant. Over the past few years, a lot of people have said to me, how does it feel to be rich? At first, I was kind of offended. There seemed to be an implied criticism in the question. But I'm over that. I tell them it doesn't feel any special way. The way I feel is, but this is going to sound stuffy. No, I don't think it's stuffy, said Mrs. Lilienthal, anticipating what was coming. Yes, it is, but I'm going to say it anyway, said Lilienthal. I don't think money makes much difference as long as you have enough.
I don't quite agree, said Mrs. Lilienthal.
It doesn't make much difference when you're young. You don't mind then, as long as you can struggle along, but as you get older, it is helpful.
Lilienthal nodded in deference to that.
Then he said that he thought the undertone of dissatisfaction I had noticed in the journal probably stemmed, at least in part, from the fact that his career in private business, absorbing though it was, did not bring with it the gratifications of public service work. True, he had not been deprived of them entirely, because it was at the height of his minerals and chemicals operations in 1954 that he first went to Colombia, at the request of that country's government, and serving as a peso-a-year consultant, started the Cauca Valley project that was later continued by the Development and Resources Corporation. But for the most part, being a top officer of minerals and chemicals had kept him pretty well tied down, and he'd had to regard the Columbia work as a sideline, if not merely a hobby. I found it impossible to avoid seeing symbolic significance in the fact that the principal material with which Lilienthal, the businessman, had been engaged was clay. I thought of something else in Lilienthal's life at that time that might have taken some of the kick out of the process of becoming a successful businessman. His big business book had come out when he was in the thick of the minerals and chemicals work. I wondered whether, since it is such an uncritical paean to free enterprise, it had been construed by some people as a rationalization of his new career, and I asked about this.
Well, the ideas in the book were rather a shock to some of my husband's New Deal friends, all right, Mrs. Lilienthal said a bit dryly.
They needed shocking, damn it, Lilienthal burst out. He spoke with some heat, and I thought of the phrase in his journal, used there in an entirely different context, but still in reference to himself, about defensiveness shown by belligerents. After a moment, he went on in a normal tone. My wife and daughter thought I didn't spend enough time working on the book, and they were right. I wrote it in too much of a hurry. My conclusions aren't supported by enough argument. For one thing, I should have spelled out in more detail my opposition to the way the antitrust laws are administered. But the antitrust part wasn't the real trouble. The thing that really shook up some of my old friends was what I said about big industry in relation to individualism, and about the machine in relation to aesthetics. Morris Cook, who used to be administrator of the Rural Electrification Administration, he was one who was shaken up. He took me apart over the book, and I took him apart back. The anti-bigness dogmatists stopped having anything to do with me. They simply wrote me off. I wasn't hurt or disappointed. Those people are living on nostalgia. They look backward, and I try to look forward. Then, of course, there were the trust busters. They really went after me. But isn't trust busting, in the sense of breaking up big companies simply because they're big, pretty much a relic of a past era? Yes, I still think I was right in the main things I said, perhaps ahead of my time, but right.
The trouble was the timing, Mrs. Lilienthal said. The book came so close to coinciding with my husband's leaving public service and going into private business. Some people thought it represented a change in point of view induced by expediency, which it didn't.
No, Lilienthal said. The book was written mostly in 1952, but all the ideas in it were hatched while I was still in public service. For example, my idea that bigness is essential for national security came in large part out of my experiences in the AEC. The company that had the research and manufacturing facilities to make the atomic bomb an operational weapon, so engineered that it wouldn't require PhDs to use it in the field, Bell Telephone to be specific, was a big company. Because it was so big, the antitrust division of the Department of Justice was seeking to break the Bell system into several parts. Unsuccessfully, as it turned out. At the very time we in the AEC were calling on it to do a vital defense job that required unity. That seemed wrong. More generally, the whole point of view I expressed in the book goes way back to my quarrel with Arthur Morgan, the first TVA chairman in the early 30s. He had great faith in a handicraft economy. I was for large-scale industry. TVA, after all, was and is the biggest power system in the free world. In TVA, I always believed in bigness, along with decentralization. But, you know, the chapter I hoped would produce the most discussion was the one on bigness as a promoter of individualism. It did produce discussion, of a sort. I remember people, academic people mostly, coming up to me with incredulous expressions and saying something that started with, "Do you really believe?" Well, my answer would start with, "Yes, I really do believe." One other touchy matter that Lilienthal may have questioned himself about in the process of making his Wall Street fortune was the fact that in making it, he had not really needed to scream confiscation, since he had made it through a tax loophole, the stock option. Possibly there have been liberal, reformist businessmen who have refused to accept stock options on principle, although I have never heard of one doing so. And I am not convinced that such a renunciation would be a sensible or useful form of protest. In any event, I didn't ask Lilienthal about the matter. In the absence of any accepted code of journalism, every journalist writes his own, and in mine, such a question would have come close to invasion of moral privacy. In retrospect, though, I almost wish I had violated my code that one time. Lilienthal, being Lilienthal, might have objected to the question strenuously, but I think he would have answered it equally strenuously, and without hedging. As things were, after discoursing on critical reactions to his book, Big Business, he got up and walked to a window. "I see Dominic has been pretty cautious about his rose pruning," he said to his wife. "Maybe I'll go out later and cut them back some more." His jaw was set in a way that made me feel pretty sure I knew how the rose pruning controversy was going to be resolved. The triumphant solution to Lilienthal's problem, the way that he eventually found to have his cake and eat it, was the Development and Resources Corporation. The corporation arose out of a series of conversations between Lilienthal and Meyer during the spring of 1955, in the course of which Lilienthal pointed out that he was well acquainted with dozens of foreign dignitaries and technical personnel who had come to visit the TVA, and said that their intense interest in that project seemed to indicate that at least some of their countries would be receptive to the idea of starting similar programs. Our aim in forming DNR was not to try to remold the world or any large part of it, but only to try to help accomplish some rather specific things, and, incidentally, make a profit, Lilienthal told me. Andre was not so sure about the profit. We both knew there would be a deficit at first. But he liked the idea of doing constructive things, and Lazar Frere decided to back us, in return for a half-interest in the corporation. Clapp, who was serving at the time as deputy New York City administrator, came in as co-founder of the venture, and the subsequent executive appointments made DNR virtually a TVA alumni association. John Oliver, who became executive vice president, had been with TVA from 1942 to 1954, ending up as its general manager. W. L. Vorduin, who became director of engineering, had been with TVA for a decade and had planned its whole system of dams. Walton Seymour, who became vice president for industrial development, had been a TVA consultant on electric power marketing for 13 years, and a dozen other former TVA men were scattered on down through the ranks. In July 1955, DNR set up shop at 44 Wall and set to work finding clients. What was to prove its most important one came to light during a World Bank meeting in Istanbul that Lilienthal and his wife attended in September of that year. At the meeting, Lilienthal fell in with Abulhassan Ebtehaj, then head of a 7-year development plan in Iran. As it happened, Iran was just about the ideal DNR client, since, for one thing, the royalties on its nationalized oil industry gave it considerable capital with which to pay for the development of its resources. And for another, what it desperately needed was technical and professional guidance. The encounter with Eptahaj led to an invitation to Lilienthal and Clapp to visit Iran as the guests of the Shah, and see what they thought could be done about Khuzestan. Lilienthal's employment contract with Minerals and Chemicals ended that December. Although he stayed on as a director, he was now free to devote all his time, or nearly all of it, to DNR. In February 1956, he and Clapp went to Iran. "Before then, I blush to say I had never heard of Khuzestan," Lilienthal told me. "I've learned a lot about it since then. It was the heart of the Old Testament Elamite kingdom, and later of the Persian Empire. The ruins of Persepolis are not far away, and those of Susa, where King Darius had his winter palace, are in the very center of Khuzestan. In ancient times, the whole region had an extensive water conservation system. You can still find the remains of canals that were probably built by Darius 2,500 years ago. But after the decline of the Persian Empire, the water system was ruined by invasion and neglect. Lord Curzon described what the Khuzestan uplands looked like a century ago. A desert over which the eye may roam unarrested for miles. It was that way when we got there. Nowadays, Khuzestan is one of the world's richest oil fields. The famous Abadan refinery is at its southern tip. But the inhabitants, 2.5 million of them, haven't benefited from that. The rivers have flowed unused, the fabulously rich soil has lain fallow, and all but a tiny fraction of the people have continued to live in desperate poverty. When Clapp and I first saw the place, we were appalled. Still, for two old TVA hands like us, it was a dream. It was simply crying out for development. We look for sites for dams, likely spots to hunt for minerals and make soil fertility studies and so on. We saw flares of natural gas rising from oil fields. That was waste, and it suggested petrochemical plants to use the gas for making fertilizer and plastics. In 8 days, we'd roughed out a plan. And in about 2 weeks, DNR had signed a 5-year contract with the Iranian government. That was only the beginning. Bill Verduin, our chief engineer, flew out there and spotted a wonderful dam site at a place just a few miles from the ruins of Susa, a narrow canyon with walls that rise almost vertically from the bed of the Dez River. We found we were going to have to manage the project as well as advise on it, and so our next job was lining up our managerial group. To give you some idea of the size of the project, right now there are about 700 people working on it at the professional level, 100 Americans, 300 Iranians, and 300 others, mostly Europeans, who work directly for firms under subcontracts. Besides that, there are about 4,700 Iranian laborers, over 5,000 people all told. The entire plan includes 14 dams on 5 different rivers and will take many years to finish. DNR has just completed its first contract for 5 years and signed a new one for 1.5 years, with option to renew for another 5 years. Quite a bit has been accomplished already. Take the first dam, the Dez one. It's to be 620 feet high, or more than half again as high as the Aswan in Egypt. And it will eventually irrigate 360,000 acres and generate 520,000 kilowatts of electricity. It should be finished early in 1963. Meanwhile, a sugar plantation, the first in Khuzestan in 25 centuries, has been started with irrigation by pumped water. It should yield its first crop this summer, and a sugar refinery will be ready by the time the sugar is. Another thing. Eventually, the region will supply its own electric power from the dams. But for the interim period, a high-tension line, the first anywhere in Iran, has been put in over the 72 miles from Abadan to Awaz, a city of 120,000 that previously had no power source, except half a dozen little diesels which seldom worked. While the Iranian project was proceeding, DNR was also busy lining up and carrying out its programs for Italy, Colombia, Ghana,
the Ivory Coast, and Puerto Rico, as well as programs for private business groups in Chile and the Philippines. A job that DNR had just taken on for the United States Army Corps of Engineers excited Lilienthal enormously. An investigation of the economic impact of power from a proposed dam on the Alaskan sector of the Yukon, which he described as the river with the greatest hydroelectric potential remaining on this continent. Meanwhile, the Czar Frère retained its financial interest in the firm and now very happily collected its share of a substantial annual profit, and Lilienthal happily took to teasing Meyer about his former skepticism as to DNR financial prospects. Lilienthal's new career had meant a highly peripatetic life, both for him and for Mrs. Lilienthal. He showed me his foreign travel log for 1960, which he said was a fairly typical year, and it read as follows. January 23 to March 26, Honolulu, Tokyo, Manila, Iligan, Mindanao, Manila, Bangkok, Siem Reap, Bangkok, Tehran, Awaz, Andimashek, Awaz, Tehran, Geneva, Brussels, Madrid, home. October 11th to the 17th, Buenos Aires, Patagonia, home. November 18th to December 5th, London, Tehran, Rome, Milan, Paris, home. Then he went and got the volume of his journal that relates to those trips. Turning to the pages on his stay in Iran early last spring, I was particularly struck by a few excerpts. Awaz, March 5th. The cry of the Arab women as the Shah's big black Chrysler passed them, a solid row along the road from the airport, made me think of the rebel yell. Then I recognized it. It was the Indian yelp, the kind we used to make as kids, moving our hand over our mouths to give that undulating wail. Awaz, March 11th. Our experience in the villagers' huts on Wednesday threw me into a deep pit. I hovered between despair, which is an emotion I consider a sin, and anger, which doesn't do much good, I suppose. Andimashek, March 9th. We have traveled many miles, through dust, mud holes, where we got stuck fast, and some of the roughest roads I've ever known. And we also traveled back to the 9th century, and earlier, visiting villages and going into mud homes. Quite unbelievable, and unforgettable forever and ever. As the biblical oath has it, let my right hand wither, if I ever forget how some of the most attractive of my fellow human beings live, are living tonight, only a few kilometers from here, where we visited them this afternoon. And yet, I'm sure, as I am writing these notes, that the Gebli area, of only 45,000 acres, swallowed in the vastness of the Khuzestan, would become as well known as, say, the community of Tupelo became, or New Harmony or Salt Lake City, when it was founded by a handful of dedicated men in the pass of the Great Rockies. The afternoon shadows were getting long on Battle Road, and it was time for me to be going. Lilienthal walked out to my car with me, and on the way I asked him whether he ever missed the rough and tumble, and the limelight of being perhaps the most controversial man in Washington. He grinned and said, "Sure." When we reached the car, he went on, "I never intended to be especially combative in Washington or in the Tennessee Valley. It was just that people kept disagreeing with me. But all right, I wouldn't have put myself in controversial situations so much if I hadn't wanted to. I guess I was combative. When I was a kid, I was interested in boxing. At high school, in Michigan City, Indiana, I boxed a lot with a cousin of mine. And while I was in college at DePaul in central Indiana, I took to boxing during the summers with a man who had been a professional light heavyweight. The Tacoma Tiger, he'd been called. Working out with him was a challenge. If I made a mistake, I'd be on the floor. I wanted just once to land on him good. It was my ambition. I never did, of course, but I got to be a fairly good boxer. I became boxing coach at DePaul while I was an undergraduate. Later on, at Harvard Law, I didn't have time to keep it up, and I never boxed seriously again. but I don't think that for me boxing was an expression of combativeness for its own sake. I think I considered competence at defending yourself a means of preserving your personal independence. I learned that from my father. Be your own man, he used to say. He'd come from Austria-Hungary, the part that's now eastern Czechoslovakia in the 1880s, when he was about 20, and he spent his adult life as a storekeeper in various Middle Western towns. Morton, Illinois, where I was born, Valparaiso, Indiana, Springfield, Missouri, Michigan City, and later Winnemac, Indiana. He had very pale blue eyes that reflected the insides of him. You could tell by looking at him that he wouldn't trade independence for security. He didn't know how to dissemble, and wouldn't have wanted to if he had known how. Well, to get back to my being controversial or combative, or whatever you call it, in Washington, yes, there's something missing when you don't have a McKellar laying it on the line anymore. The moral equivalent of that for me now is taking on challenges. Different kinds of McKellars, or Tacoma Tigers, maybe. The minerals and chemicals thing, the DNR thing, and trying to meet them. I revisited Lilienthal in early summer 1968. This time at DNR's third home office, a suite with a splendid harbor view at 1 Whitehall Street. Both DNR and he had moved along in the interim. In Khuzestan, the Dez Dam had been completed on schedule. Water impounding had begun in November 1962. The first power had been delivered in May 1963, and the region was now not only supplying its own power, but producing enough surplus to attract foreign industry. Meanwhile, agriculture in the once barren region was flourishing as a result of irrigation made possible by the dam and, as Lilienthal, 68 now, and as combative as ever, put it, "The gloomy economists have to be gloomy about some other underdeveloped country." DNR had just signed a new 5-year contract with Iran to carry on the work. Otherwise, the firm had expanded its clientele to include 14 countries. Its most controversial undertaking was in Vietnam, where, under contract with the United States government, it was cooperating with a similar group of South Vietnamese and working up plans for the post-war development of the Mekong Valley. This assignment had led to criticism of Lilienthal by those who took it to imply that he supported the war. In fact, he told me, he regarded the war as the disastrous outcome of a series of horrible miscalculations, and the planning of post-war resources development as a separate matter. It was clear enough, nevertheless, that the criticism hurt. At the same time, DNR was widening its horizons by beginning to move, unexpectedly, into domestic urban development, having been engaged by private foundation-sponsored groups in Queens County, New York, and Oakland County, Michigan, to see whether the TVA approach might have some value in dealing with those modern deserts, the slums. "Just pretend this is Zambia, and tell us what you would do," these groups had said, in effect to DNR, a wildly imaginative idea, surely, the usefulness of which remained to be proved. As for DNR itself and its place in American business, Lilienthal recounted that since I had seen him, it had expanded to the extent of opening a second permanent office on the West Coast, had considerably increased its profits, and become essentially employee-owned, with Lazar retaining only a token interest. Most encouraging of all, at a time when old-line business was having serious recruitment problems because its obsession with profit was repelling high-minded youth, DNR found that its idealistic objectives made it a magnet for the most promising new graduates. And as a result of all these things, Lilienthal could at last say what he had not been able to say on the earlier occasion, that private enterprise was now affording him more satisfaction than he had ever derived from public service. Is DNR, then, a prototype of the free enterprise of the future, accountable half to its stockholders and half to the rest of humanity? If so, then the irony is complete. And Lilienthal, of all people, ends up as the prototypical businessman. Chapter 10. Stockholder Season.
A few years ago, a European diplomat was quoted in the Times as saying, "The American economy has become so big that it is beyond the imagination to comprehend." But now, on top of size, you are getting rapid growth as well. It is a situation of fundamental power unequaled in the history of the world. At about the same time, A.A. Burley wrote in a study of corporate power that the 500 or so corporations that dominate that economy represent a concentration of power over economics which makes the medieval feudal system look like a Sunday school party. As for the power within those corporations, it clearly rests, for all practical purposes, with their directors and their professional managers, often not substantial owners, who, Burley goes on to suggest in the same essay, sometimes constitute a self-perpetuating oligarchy. Most fair-minded observers these days seem to feel that the stewardship of the oligarchs, from a social point of view, isn't anything like as bad as it might be, and in many cases is pretty good. Yet, however that may be, the ultimate power theoretically does not reside in them at all. According to the corporate form of organization, it resides in the stockholders, of whom, in United States business enterprises of all sizes and descriptions, there are more than 20 million. Even though the courts have repeatedly ruled that a director does not have to follow stockholder instructions any more than a congressman has to follow the instructions of his constituents, stockholders nevertheless do elect directors on the logical, if not exactly democratic, basis of one share, one vote. The stockholders are deprived of their real power by a number of factors, among which are their indifference to it in times of rising profits and dividends, their ignorance of corporate affairs, and their sheer numbers. One way or another, they vote the management slate, and the results of most director elections have a certain Russian ring. 99% or more of the votes cast in favor. The chief, and in many cases the only, occasion when stockholders make their presence felt by management is at the annual meeting. Company annual meetings are customarily held in the spring. And one spring, it was that of 1966, I made the rounds of a few of them to get a line on what the theoretical holders of all that feudal power had to say for themselves, and also on the state of their relations with their elected directors. What particularly commended the 1966 season to me was that it promised to be a particularly lively one. Various reports of a new hard-line approach by company managements to stockholders had appeared in the press. I was charmed by the notion of a candidate for office announcing his new hard-line approach to voters right before an election. The new approach, it was reported, was the upshot of events at the previous year's meetings, where a new high in stockholder unruliness was reached. The chairman of the Communications Satellite Corporation was forced to call on guards to eject bodily two badgering stockholders at his company's meeting in Washington. Harland C. Forbes, who was then the chairman of Consolidated Edison, ordered one heckler off the premises in New York. And in Philadelphia, American Telephone and Telegraph Chairman Frederick R. Capel was goaded into announcing abruptly, "This meeting is not being run by Robert's Rules of Order. It's being run by me." The executive director of the American Society of Corporate Secretaries later explained that precise application of Robert's Rules would have had the effect not of increasing the stockholders' freedom of speech, but rather of restricting it. Mr. Capel, the secretary implied, had merely been protecting stockholders from parliamentary tyranny. In Schenectady, Gerald L. Filippi, chairman of General Electric, after several hours of fencing with stockholders, summed up his new hard line by saying, "I should like it to be clear that next year and in the years to come, the chair may well adopt a more rigorous attitude." According to Business Week, the General Electric management then assigned a special task force to the job of seeing what could be done about cracking down on hecklers by changing the annual meeting pattern. And early in 1966, the Bible of Management, the Harvard Business Review,
entered the lists with an article by O. Glenn Saxon, Jr., the head of a company specializing in investor services to management, in which he recommended crisply that the chairman of annual meetings recognize the authority inherent in the role of the chair and resolve to use it appropriately. Apparently, the theoretical holders of fundamental power unequaled in the history of the world were about to be put in their place. One thing I couldn't help noticing as I went over the schedule of the year's leading meetings was a trend away from holding them in or near New York. Invariably, the official reason given was that the move would accommodate stockholders from other areas who had seldom, if ever, been able to attend in the past. However, most of the noisiest dissident stockholders seemed to be based in the New York area, and the moves were taking place in the year of the new hardline, so I found the likelihood of a relationship between these two facts by no means remote. United States Steel holders, for example, were to meet in Cleveland, making their second foray outside their company's nominal home state of New Jersey since its formation in 1901. General Electric was going outside New York State for the third time in recent years, and going all the way to Georgia, a state in which management appeared to have suddenly discovered 5,600 stockholders, or a bit more than 1% of the firm's total roll, who were badly in need of a chance to attend an annual meeting. The biggest company of them all, American Telephone and Telegraph, had chosen Detroit, which was its third site outside New York City in its 81-year history, the second having been Philadelphia, where the 1965 session was held. To open my own meeting-going season, I tracked AT&T to Detroit. Leafing through some papers on the plane going out there, I learned that the number of AT&T stockholders had increased to an all-time record of almost 3 million. And I fell to wondering what would happen in the unlikely event that all of them, or even half of them, appeared in Detroit and demanded seats at the meeting. At any rate, each one of them had received by mail, a few weeks earlier, a notice of the meeting along with a formal invitation to attend, and it seemed to me almost certain that American industry had achieved another first. The first time almost 3 million individual invitations had ever been mailed out to any event of any kind anywhere. My fears on the first score were put to rest when I got to Cobo Hall, a huge riverfront auditorium where the meeting was to take place. The hall was far from filled. The Yankees in their better days would have been disgusted with such a turnout on any weekday afternoon. The papers next day said the attendance was 4,016. Looking around, I noticed in the crowd several families with small children. One woman in a wheelchair, one man with a beard, and just two Negro stockholders, the last observation suggesting that the trumpeters of people's capitalism might well do some coordinating with the civil rights movement. The announced time of the meeting was 1:30, and Chairman Capel entered on the dot and marched to a reading stand on the platform. The 18 other AT&T directors trooped to a row of seats just behind him, and Mr. Capel gaveled the meeting to order. From my reading and from annual meetings that I'd attended in past years, I knew that the meetings of the biggest companies are usually marked by the presence of so-called professional stockholders, persons who make a full-time occupation of buying stock in companies or obtaining the proxies of other stockholders, then informing themselves more or less intimately about the corporation's affairs and attending annual meetings to raise questions or propose resolutions, and that the most celebrated members of this breed were Mrs. Wilma Soss of New York, who heads an organization of women stockholders and votes the proxies of its members, as well as her own shares, and Lewis D. Gilbert, also of New York, who represents his own holdings and those of his family, a considerable total. Something I did not know, and learned at the AT&T meeting, and at others I attended subsequently, was that apart from the prepared speeches of management, a good many big company meetings really consist of a dialogue. In some cases, it's more of a duel between the chairman and the few professional stockholders. The contributions of non-professionals run strongly to ill-informed or tame questions and windy encomiums of management. And thus the task of making cogent criticisms or asking embarrassing questions falls to the professionals. Though largely self-appointed, they become, by default, the sole representatives of a huge constituency that may badly need representing. Some of them are not very good representatives, and a few are so bad that their conduct raises a problem in American manners. These few repeatedly say things at annual meetings, boorish, silly, insulting, or abusive things, that are apparently permissible by corporate rules, but are certainly impermissible by drawing room rules, and sometimes succeed in giving the annual meetings of mighty companies the general air of barnyard squabbles. Mrs. Soss, a former public relations woman who has been a tireless professional stockholder since 1947, is usually a good many cuts above this level. True, she is not beyond playing to the gallery by wearing bizarre costumes to meetings. She tries with occasional success to taunt recalcitrant chairmen into throwing her out. She is often scolding and occasionally abusive, and nobody could accuse her of being unduly concise. I confess that her customary tone and manner set my teeth on edge, but I can't help recognizing that, because she does her homework, she usually has a point. Mr. Gilbert, who has been at it since 1933 and is the dean of them all, almost invariably has a point. And by comparison with his colleagues, he is the soul of brevity and punctilio, as well as of dedication and diligence. Despised, as professional stockholders are, by most company managements, Mrs. Soss and Mr. Gilbert are widely enough recognized to be listed in Who's Who in America. Furthermore, for what satisfaction it may bring them, they are the nameless Agamemnons and Ajaxes, invariably called individuals in some of the prose epics produced by the business establishment itself. The greater portion of the discussion period was taken up by questions and statements of a few individuals on matters that can scarcely be deemed relevant. Two individuals interrupted the opening statement of the chairman. The chairman advised the individuals who had interrupted to choose between ceasing their interruption or leaving the meeting. So reads in part the official report of the 1965 AT&T annual meeting. And although Mr. Saxon's piece in the Harvard Business Review was entirely about professional stockholders and how to deal with them, the author's corporate dignity did not permit him to mention the name of even one of them. Avoiding this was quite a trick, but Mr. Saxon pulled it off. Both Mrs. Soss and Mr. Gilbert were present at Cobo Hall. Indeed, the meeting had barely got underway before Mr. Gilbert was on his feet, complaining that several resolutions he had asked the company to include in the proxy statement and the meeting agenda had been omitted from both. Mr. Cappell, a stern-looking man with steel-rimmed spectacles, who was unmistakably cast in the old-fashioned, aloof corporate mold rather than the new, more permissive one, replied shortly that the Gilbert proposals had referred to matters that were not proper for stockholder consideration and had been submitted too late anyhow. Mr. Cappell then announced that he was about to report on company operations, whereupon the 18 other directors filed off the platform. Evidently, they had been there only to be introduced, not to field questions from stockholders. Exactly where they went, I don't know. They vanished from my field of vision, and I wasn't enlightened when, later on in the meeting, Mr. Cappell responded to a stockholder's question as to their whereabouts with a laconic statement, "They're here." Going it alone, Mr. Cappell said in his report that business is booming, earnings are good, and the prospect ahead is for more of the same. Declared that AT&T was eager for the Federal Communications Commission to get on with its investigation of telephone rates, since the company had no skeletons in the closet, and then painted a picture of a bright telephonic future, in which picture phones will be commonplace and light beams will carry messages. When Mr. Cappell's address was over, and the management-sponsored slate of directors for the coming year had been duly nominated, Mrs. Soss rose to make a nomination of her own. Dr. Francis Arkin, a psychoanalyst. In explanation, Mrs. Saw said that she felt AT&T ought to have a woman on its board, and that furthermore, she sometimes felt some of the company's executives would be benefited by occasional psychiatric examinations. This remark seemed to me gratuitous, but the balance of manners between bosses and stockholders was subsequently redressed, at least to my mind, at another meeting, when the chairman suggested that some of his firm's stockholders ought to see a psychiatrist. The nomination of Dr. Arkin was seconded by Mr. Gilbert, although not until Mrs. Soss, who was sitting a couple of seats from him, had reached over and nudged him vigorously in the ribs. Presently, a professional stockholder named Evelyn Y. Davis protested the venue of the meeting, complaining that she had been forced to come all the way from New York by bus. Mrs. Davis, a brunette, was the youngest and perhaps the best-looking of the professional stockholders, but, on the basis of what I saw at the AT&T meeting and others, not the best-informed or the most temperate, serious-minded or worldly-wise. On this occasion, she was greeted by thunderous boos, and when Mr. Campbell answered her by saying, "You're out of order. You're just talking to the wind," he was loudly cheered. It was only then that I understood the nature of the advantage that the company had gained by moving its meetings away from New York. It had not succeeded in shaking off the gadflies, but it had succeeded in putting them in a climate where they were subject to the rigors of that great American emotion, regional pride. A lady in a flowered hat, who said she was from Des Plaines, Illinois, emphasized the point by rising to say, "I wish some of the people here would behave like intelligent adults rather than two-year-olds." Prolonged applause. Even so, the sniping from the east went on, and by 3:30, when the meeting had been in session for 2 hours, Mr. Campbell was clearly getting testy. He began pacing impatiently around the platform, and his answers got shorter and shorter. "Okay, okay," was all he replied to one complaint that he was dictatorial. The climax came in a wrangle between him and Mrs. Soss about the fact that AT&T, although it had listed the business affiliations of its nominees for director in a pamphlet that was handed out at the meeting, had failed to list them in the material mailed out to the stockholders, the overwhelming majority of whom were not at the meeting and had done their voting by proxy. Most other big companies make such disclosures in their mailed proxy statements, so the stockholders were apparently entitled to a reasonable explanation of why AT&T had failed to do so. But somewhere along the way, reason was left behind. As the exchange progressed, Mrs. Soss adopted a scolding tone, and Mr. Campbell an icy one. As for the crowd, it was having a fine time booing the Christian, if that is what Mrs. Soss represented, and cheering the lion, if that is what Mr. Campbell represented. "I can't hear you, sir," Mrs. Soss said at one point. "Well, if you'd just listen instead of talking," Mr. Campbell returned. Then Mrs. Soss said something I didn't catch, and it must have been a telling bit of chairman baiting, because Mr. Campbell's manner changed completely, from ice to fire. He began shaking his finger and saying he wouldn't stand for any more abuse, and the floor microphone that Mrs. Soss had been using was abruptly turned off, followed at a distance of 10 or 15 feet by a uniformed security guard, and to the accompaniment of deafening booing and stamping, Mrs. Soss marched up the aisle and took a stand in front of the platform, facing Mr. Campbell, who informed her that he knew she wanted him to have her thrown out, and that he declined to comply. Eventually, Mrs. Soss went back to her seat and everybody calmed down. The rest of the meeting, given over largely to questions and comments from amateur stockholders rather than professional ones, was certainly less lively than what had gone before, and not noticeably higher in intellectual content. Stockholders from Grand Rapids, Detroit, and Ann Arbor all expressed the view that it would be best to let the directors run the company, although the Grand Rapids man objected mildly that the Bell telephone hour couldn't be received on television in his locality anymore. A man from Pleasant Ridge, Michigan, spoke up for retired stockholders who would like AT&T to plow less of its earnings back into expansion so that it could pay higher dividends. a stockholder from rural Louisiana, stated that when he picked up his telephone lately, the operator didn't answer for 5 or 10 minutes. "I bring it to your attention," the Louisiana man said, and Mr. Capel promised to have somebody look into the matter. Mrs. Davis raised a complaint about AT&T's contributions to charity, giving Mr. Capel the opportunity to reply that he was glad the world contained people more charitable than she. Tax-exempt applause. A Detroit man said, "I hope you won't let the abuse you've been subjected to by a few malcontents keep you from bringing the meeting back to the Great Midwest again." It was announced that Dr. Arkin had been defeated for a seat on the board, since she had received a vote of only 19,106 shares against some 400 million, proxy votes included, for each candidate on the management slate. By approving the management slate, a proxy voter can, in effect, oppose a floor nomination, even though he knows nothing about it. And that was how the 1966 annual meeting of the world's largest company went. Or how it went until 5:30, when all but a few hundred stockholders had left, and when I headed for the airport to catch a plane back to New York. The AT&T meeting left me in a thoughtful mood. Annual meetings, I reflected, can be times to try the soul of an admirer of representative democratic government, especially when he finds himself guiltily sympathizing with the chairman who is being badgered from the floor. The professional stockholders, in their wilder moments, are management's secret weapon. A Mrs. Soss and a Mrs. Davis, at their most strident, could have made Commodore Vanderbilt and Pierpont Morgan seem like affable old gentlemen. And they can make a latter-day magnate like Mr. Capel seem like a henpecked husband, if not actually a champion of stockholders' rights. At such moments, the professional stockholders become, from a practical standpoint, enemies of intelligent dissent. On the other hand, I thought, they deserve sympathy too, whether or not one believes they have right on their side, because they are in the position of representing a constituency that doesn't want to be represented. It's hard to imagine anyone more reluctant to claim his democratic rights, or more suspicious of anyone who tries to claim them for him, than a dividend-fattened stockholder. And of course, most stockholders are thoroughly dividend-fattened.